Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
What's up, everyone, and welcome to another special episode of IndiePod, where we get to talk to the people behind some of our favorite indie games. Today, we have Cooley Callahan, and I didn't even ask how you pronounced your name before that, so I hope that I got it right.
You nailed it.
Bro, awesome. I'm so happy. And you are the environment artist behind the upcoming title known as Moss Book 2. Thank you for joining.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Joshua.
I am so glad to have you on because Moss is such a lovely experience. I wish that I wish I had a VR set because Moss has always been one of the games that I've wanted to play and I've seen. And it looks so nice.
Thank you.
Of course. The environment is great. I love it.
Yeah, the environments are pretty great. Yeah, totally. I didn't work on Moss 1, so I can say that.
Oh, okay. There you go. Well, that answers one of my initial questions. So before we dive into the game, one of the things that I love doing is always just getting to know the people behind the games because, you know, games are magic sometimes, but there's actually people behind there working on it. So, Cooley, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? How'd you get into game creation in the first place?
Yeah, well, I grew up definitely interested in video games. My parents had a Super Nintendo or just actually a NES. And I don't remember it, but my grandparents and parents would tell me I would just sit there and watch them play for hours. And so I was mesmerized at an early age. And then as I got older, I was over at some friends of the family's house for dinner. And they had a couple of sons who were about my age. And they're like, hey, we're going to go play this new computer game we have. You want to come watch? And it just so happened to be Command & Conquer. And I was like hooked. It blew my mind. And I just couldn't get enough of it. I didn't even want to play. I just wanted to watch them.
The early days of Twitch.
Yes, totally. I was like the first Twitch chat. but it just captivated me. And then, then I went through school and kind of thought about what I wanted to do. And I thought that I wanted to be an architect. And so I went to school for that. But when I graduated, I wasn't so sure I actually wanted to go into architecture. And I met someone who went through the same program as I did. And he worked at Bungie. And when I found that out, I was like, you know, my mind was blown again. I was just like, oh my gosh, I have to meet this guy. Like, this is like unbelievable. And the way that I found out that he worked at Bungie was one of my professors was, I expressed to him that I was interested in doing something that was not architecture. And he's like, oh, you know, we've got a student who did that. He works in video games now, I think. And he just sent me some of his work. You want to see it? And I was like, oh yeah, of course. And so he pulls it up and it's Epitaph, which is a Halo 3 map that I loved playing on. And I was like, oh, what? And so totally freaked out. And then I had the chance to meet him and grew that network connection. It took a couple years. I had to teach myself 3D. I learned a little bit about 3D in college, but nothing more than like an introductory Maya class, right? In which I didn't even do the assignments. I ended up just like making whatever I wanted to make. And I think I got a C in that class because the professor was like, good job, I guess, but you didn't do any of the assignments. And then after that, I met a bunch of people at PolyArch and, who were, friends from Bungie, and then they left to start PolyArch. And then back in August of 2019, I I started here, and now I'm helping with Moss Book 2. That brings us right now.
Yeah, that's awesome. So did you have any relation at the point of like working on Moss Book 1, or you joined afterwards?
Completely all the way after. I didn't work on any of the Moss content. I didn't work on any Twilight Garden. I haven't shipped any Moss content yet.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So, because originally I was going to ask kind of the origin stories of the company, but it makes more sense now with your, joining the team. What was it about this team that interests you, right? Why, why was it? Was it more of just the connection of, you know, being able to get in? Was there something about like, I really want to be into this VR world? Like, what drew your attention to this?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing that happened was I realized I wanted to leave Bungie and grow my abilities as a game developer. Mm-hmm. I wanted to branch out more into being a designer and shipping design content and owning design experiences. And so after I kind of had come to that conclusion, I started to think, okay, well, what am I going to do? Like, I can't just go be indie right now. I want to go, well, maybe I could, but I wasn't interested in that. I knew that I wanted to kind of intermediate step where if I was going to go full indie, I think I would, I was like, yeah, I probably should ship something with a smaller team first, like take on like the next bite. I don't want it to be too big,
Right. Yeah. Jumping to like, I'm with this bigger studio to then say, I'm just going to be on my own or be with only one to two other people and just do our own thing is an incredible task nonetheless, but with not that much experience from shipping with a smaller team is definitely a little bit nerve wracking, if you will.
Yeah. I think the timeline makes a lot of sense when you kind of step back and look at it. I think, Tam and Danny and Chris, sort of being the original founders, Tam representing the engineering and business side, Danny representing the design, and then Chris representing the art side. They all together have a ton of experience and, they're very senior, and Tam has started multiple companies, in the past. And so he has, business administration, experience. And so it was like, okay, so they left and did their thing. And we actually bumped into each other at E3 one time. We were showing Gambit, I think, for Forsaken. I want to say that was like 2017. And they were showing Moss, and we bumped into each other. And we're like, whoa, hey, like, what's going on? It was so cool to see you. Polyarch popped into my head like right away when I realized that I was going to leave. And so I just talked to Tam, and they were looking for environment artists at the time. So it happened to be a great time for both of us. And we did a full loop, did the full interview process, of course, and just have to give everybody on the team a chance to, give their input and to meet me. So it's not like I, got to cut, the process or anything like that.
But I'm sure those connections helped, right?
They do, because we work together. Like, Danny and I have been in like so many multiplayer play tests at Bungie together. Like, we were practically, on the same team. I mean, we kind of were Sandbox, and I was working on the PvP maps at the time. And so, every day we were up in the lab, and he was building the Arc Strider at the time. So he was building the Arc Strider Super with the lightning staff. So I remember when that was coming in, that was pretty fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. So before we dive into the actual game for this episode, I wanted to just ask kind of a simple question, or maybe not, but what does your day-to-day look like working on this game? What does an environment artist really do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you say that. We just did a Twitch stream where I streamed for 2 hours just kind of working on one of the Moss rooms.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it was really cool to be able to stream working on a game that doesn't even have a ship date yet. and it was pretty much just to show off the process.
Right.
And so, I kind of we have a lot of meetings in the morning. We typically front load all of our rituals and sort of more of the like routine in the morning. You know, everybody's waking up, kind of chatting about what's going to happen that day. And then we go off and break off into our, you know, our own things. And either we are, you know, working out of Jira, working on tasks, or, you know, having conversations about what's ready for art to hit. Like currently our art director is on vacation. And so right before he left, we had kind of a download of the next area that we're going to start finishing. And, and so just kind of building alignment, that's happening constantly, right? Like just double checking and saying like, hey, did that go anywhere? That conversation we had. And when the team is like 35 people, it's and not even the full, you know, 35 people are all working on Moss Book 2.
Right.
It's a manageable size where, you know, sometimes things can kind of get away from you, but you know, we found that it's at least from my perspective, I'm sure the directors will have their own.
Yeah, of course.
But from my point of view, things seem to be covered pretty well. And so, yeah. And then we play test twice a week in the studio. And so we try to have externals play test as much as possible right now, because we are kind of trying to close the game and finish it.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to have that exposure to like just all it, we need to find those blind spots, right? Just like right. Test all those assumptions and just make sure that, you know, players aren't getting caught up on stuff that isn't important. And bugs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, sounds pretty normal. I like the idea of humanizing this. When people talk about making games, you kind of, if you're not part of that industry or you don't really know what goes into it, you kind of just think that everyone codes, right?
Right.
Or that everything just kind of happens. It's interesting hearing that you're using these process tools like Jira and things that a lot of people from a business perspective, like if you're in corporate America or wherever you are, you probably know of these tools. And it's one of those things hearing it where I'm like, oh man, I can't believe boring old me also uses possibly the same tools as all these cool developers. You know, it's like, which also probably means there's a lot of boring parts to game development as well.
there are certainly moments that aren't as exciting, but yeah, I mean, the tools are good, right? Like collaboration and communication and
delegation,
right? Like delegating tasks, even that takes a lot of effort.
Of course, especially, I mean, I think it's, you know, when you think of like an indie team, there's there's definitely a disparity. Like the term indie has kind of gotten blown up out of proportion. And there's, you know, the idea of I'm a one person team, I'm a three person team. And that's kind of where people think of indie, where it's like, oh, just you do everything and things just happen. Right. But especially you get into these indie teams that are more of a larger scale, which I would equate to yours, which has, you know, a good amount of people. It's so hard when everyone has their own task or their own piece of the pie that they have to work on to make sure that pie fits together at the end of the day.
It really is. I mean, we have a business team, we have a, you know, a CFO, we've got, you know, Tam, you know, pinch hits as, you know, a writer and a CEO and Shauna, our HR director, does the same. She's, you know, she's writing dialogue. She's in the editor and like working with our designers daily. And so it really is, but there's still, you know, a ton of other work that she has to do to run the business. And so I think maybe we're getting to a point now where the company's big enough to where, you know, I could see us hiring a business administrator, but we'll see. I think, you know, we get a lot of outside funding, right? Like, I think that's kind of another distinguishing factor. Like we've got a publisher, you know, we've got a marketing and PR and communications director. And so we still kind of operate like a traditional, like not like a, you know, publisher owned or, you know, platform owner, you know, like Sony or Microsoft, all those studios, like we operate in a very similar way, to all of those studios. And so just the nice thing that I think the freedom that we enjoy at PolyArc is that we can make decisions on our terms,
right.
Which is really important to Tam and the business people. And I think everybody here, like we want to be very connected to our craft and our products.
Right.
We get the most, I think, satisfaction from really pouring ourselves into this experience and then sharing it with others and then seeing, you know, the reactions of people. And, you know, I've witnessed it myself, you know, when people would play Moss and just melt down and just completely fall in love with Quill. And, so I believe in that so much that it's like, yes, yeah. Like this is, you know, PolyArc has a vision. You know, we've got a vision for what Moss and for what VR and gaming in this new media can be. And so, yeah, we're trying to take that vision and make it a reality.
Yeah. And honestly, that's what I attribute to indie. The definition of indie has become so hard to really pinpoint. And I feel like it's more of a feeling than it is a real definition, but I usually pinpoint it to you're an indie team if you're able to make those decisions that matter to produce a vision and a passionate project that is not burdened by the normal qualms of like, is it going to make the most money or is it the most lucrative to a wider audience, rather than telling the story that those developers or those individual creatives want to tell.
Totally.
Which I'm super excited about. And I love hearing, especially because it makes it seem like Moss 2 won't be compromised in any way in a different fashion than what Moss 1 was, which had a lot of wide success. But that being said, I think this is probably a good time for us to transition and talk about the game.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people do know what Moss is, but for those who might not have heard anything about the series, how, give me like your elevator pitch or just what makes Moss special? You talked about people breaking down and falling in love with that main character. You know, what is this game and what does make it special?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like I'm trying to think back to when I first was hearing about Moss, and it is a little confusing, right? Like it's hard to close your eyes and like, it was hard to imagine what it was. But I'll do my best.
So, in
the game of Moss, you play as a reader, and as the reader, you are in a magic library with all of these books in it. And when you open the book, you're transported into the world, and the book that you're reading is all about Quill, who is a small mouse who lives in the clearing in a magic forest in this, you know, magic fairy tale land with, you know, sprites and other animals and, you know, magic and enemies and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, and because you are a reader and you're not the main character, Quill, you're observing her and you're helping her, and you still control her as a character, like in a traditional game. But she, you know, she has her own thoughts, she has her own feelings, and she expresses them to you. And you go on this journey together, and she will help you with puzzles, and you'll defeat enemies along the way. And the whole premise of the story is that Quill goes for a walk one day and finds a magic piece of glass. And that magic piece of glass enables her to see you. And now she's the only one that can see you. And shortly after that, her uncle disappears. And so you help her on a journey to go find her uncle. And that ultimately leads you to a castle that has long been abandoned. And inside that castle, you'll take on the serpent Sarfog, who is arcane enemy that has, all of these enemies that are sort of taking over the land of Moss, and that will be your main antagonist throughout the game. But anyways, I'm starting to ramble, but
No. I mean, I like the cliff notes because this is basically like, for those who haven't played the first one, that's basically where you get to now this second book, right?
Correct.
That is that intro to, if you haven't played the first one, which you should, that's what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And then now we have this second story, which I think, you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that I love and I want to talk about. But one of my first things that I thought about with this was at the end of the game, you have to the nature of giving that, hey, there's more coming. There's like, you'll find out more in the next chapter kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I thought interesting was it kind of could have been its own self-contained thing. It could have wrapped up mm-hmm. there. Moss could have been mm-hmm. over, right? Mm-hmm. What was it, especially, you know, you joined afterwards, but I'm sure there's mm-hmm. some of that discussion on like, what was it that made the team kind of distinguish this as something that needed to be more of a series, right?
Mm-hmm. I think probably, I mean, the biggest thing is just the realities of the business, which was time and money. So an interesting fact about Moss One, and I guess Moss Book Two, is that the story of Book Two is actually the full script for the first game.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and pretty early on, they realized like, this game is huge. We can't make all of this, so we need to find the best part, the best point at which we can, you know, put in a like, stay tuned, and you know, let's wrap this up another time. And I think at that point it was, you know, kind of a risky move, right? Because they didn't know if the game was going to be a hit. They were still, you know, out there trying to make this thing happen. And so,
That story could have been lost at this point, because yep. if it didn't become a hit, then you would have just been like, well, half a story was put out and that's all. And now we have to, you know, find something else to do that might be lucrative.
Totally. Someone would have to dig up the rights for it like 20 years from now or something. it's true. And so, thankfully the game was a success, and people were craving more, and people were craving for a longer experience as well. And that happened to kind of play in nicely with, okay, like, wow, now Polyarch has years where they had months, and now we have, you know, a team of people where we had half of a person. And so it's, the game's definitely bigger. The game is definitely bigger.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions, because there was a lot of concern, or not really concern, but a little bit of criticism around the length of this game. Mm-hmm. Since this was that original script that got kind of cut down into possibly two pieces, or, you know, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. is this going to be a kind of fill that void that some of those criticisms pointed out to? What are we thinking from, and don't give like obviously a specific number, but is this going to be a much longer game in comparison?
Well, certainly that's the hope. I think, you know, we would love to make as long of a game as possible, really. I mean, to a degree, like, I think ideally you don't want the like length of the game to really be a constraint. Like, you want to like imagine what's the best game and what's the best story, and then let's tell that. And, you know, if it's too long, okay, we'll like, you know, trim it down. But, you know, it sucks to like be like, man, like, we want to tell this whole story, but we just can't. We just don't have the resources.
Right.
And having to chop it up afterwards is much more painful and not as preferable, I guess.
No, I understand that, because it's an interesting concern. It feels very much the, you know, live to be the villain, die the hero kind of catchphrase that I always forget exactly the words to, and yet I always try to bring it up. But it's basically, it's basically the idea, right, that maybe a reason why people loved it so much was because it was a shorter experience, because they you gave them that feeling of wanting more, right? They still craved more of it, as opposed to if it was too long, they might have said, this game is good, but it gets boring because it's, you know, it's drawn out too long, right?
Yeah.
Whereas this way, it changes that narrative to be like, oh, here's a little piece of it. Are you interested? Wait for book two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're 100% right. That's a great observation. It's scary to think about, you know, because, you know, you're right. You could potentially be missing something
Right.
And sometimes you miss something big like that. But when we've kind of looked at all of the data and we've looked at so many of the reviews, like it's to a point where we just know that, in general, a longer game would have pleased more people. And it's not that they would have wanted the same amount of content stretched out over a longer period of time. I think they just wanted more Moss content. They wanted more rooms, more puzzles with Quill, more reactions from Quill, more book sequences, more music, more bosses, more enemies. And they want that to be paced well, right? Like pacing is, especially in the story game, in a single player game, pacing is everything. If you don't have your pacing right, that's the thing you're talking about, right? It's the player's like, yeah, cool game, looks cute and nice graphics, but like, man, like I don't want to kill bugs for 30 minutes. Like I'm going to go do something else.
So what is the team doing then in that consideration? Because I'm sure this is a hot topic amongst all of you. Mm-hmm. What is the team doing to keep that pacing in mind, right?
Yeah, this is great. I'm so glad you asked this question because I literally was just talking to a friend of mine, and he's actually my mentor at Bungie. He's working on an indie game called Binary Smoke, and they showed it off at the Epic Indie Showcase, I think. I want to say it was last year. Definitely check it out. But we were literally just talking about this, and over the course of Moss Book 2, the designers built a bunch of mechanics, and we have new weapons, we have new devices, we have new enemies. And as we were building all of that stuff, we don't really know how to pace things, right? That's really not what we're thinking about. We're thinking about like, how can we make this device really fun? Like, how can we make this enemy really fun? Like, what's a good level design for this enemy type, this new enemy type that we just created? And so we spent a lot of time focusing on that, and then we get some designs that we like that play test well, we polish those up, and then we kind of have the gameplay content that we need. But then what we noticed was we did a full playable not too long ago, and maybe like the beginning of the year, where we took everything and we like took all the little pieces that we kind of had been working on or noodling on in isolation or whatever, and because we kind of recognized like, wow, we haven't played start to finish yet. And so we took everything, right, and we just smashed it into one big kind of buggy mess. And the whole team stopped and played it, and we gave feedback, and that kind of, then we mapped it. So we put all that together, and then we mapped out like a timeline, right? Like we mapped out like, where are all of our beats and what are they, and how are we using all of the mechanics and whatnot. And it was a little painful because we found, obviously pivots that we wanted to make. We saw like, hey, like, oh, we're not using this mechanic in this chapter at all. It's like, we use it over here, but then like you go a chapter and you don't see it at all, and then we use it over here. That's kind of weird. Like, it doesn't feel right. Like, let's work on that. We shook everything up, and like it settled, right? And it settled into a better place and had more of a flow to it. And that's all a high level design task that the design leads and all of the designers work on together to propose, and then sort of like divvy up the work to say like, okay, all right, I'll own this area and I'll make the changes here, and then we'll play test it. Well, there, you're doing that over there. And so we kind of did that. We just did that whole process a couple months ago, and it's been great. And now we're in the process of play testing all of that, and we're adding all of the player objective stuff. So like, we're writing, VO lines, we're writing narrator lines, we're writing, prompts and stuff that tell the player what they're doing, remind them, hey, like, it's all the player objective design work that needs to go in to just keep the player on track.
Right.
And you really only want to do that when you've got your flow pinned down. Like, it's kind of like a final step that you want to do, because if you need to change something, then you're going back to writing again, and going back to writing happens, but like, you really don't want to send things back up. Like, once things come down from writing and from audio, you want to, as much as possible, have that stuff be final.
That's honestly, this is fascinating because I've never really thought about the, you know, incremental steps that go into this and how it becomes, almost like it's a blend of agile and waterfall practices because of the fact that there's just so many pieces that go into it. And I never really, you know, when I think of it, I would assume that those pieces would all get kind of more or less finished and be bite-sized chunks that are like, oh, everything is literally done in this, and then you slap it together. But you're 100% right that it wouldn't make sense to do it that way because of the fact that you might find something to the nature of, oh, we're not using this mechanic, we need to totally change this up because you know, this piece by itself might feel nice, but once you mash it together, it doesn't make sense.
Exactly. And that is true for pretty much everything in the game, from the environment art to the, you know, to the narration, to the, you know, it's, if you're not consistent from going from one space to the next, it's really jarring, and we want to make sure that it's smooth and makes sense and, you know, it doesn't do anything to take the player out of the immersion. Right.
Now, you touched upon a point that I wanted to bring up because you had said that you were adding these new weapons and these new mechanics and trying to improve, right? It's a new game. It's the continuation. You want to make it an improvement. What are some of those things from a mechanical side or inside the game that the players will really notice going from one to two that in your mind is that like, this is the game seller, right? Like these are the things that are super cool. These are the selling points that people should know.
Yeah. Okay. I think so. We did show a few of these new things in the announcement trailer, which I'll just go ahead and plug that. It's really cool. You should totally watch it if you haven't watched it already. It's you can find it on our YouTube, and I think you can find it on Sony's YouTube as well. But we have a hammer. Cole's going to get a hammer, and that is just like, it's just dumb fun, right? You're just smashing everything. And we've also built some puzzles with the hammer that are pretty cool. So in the first game, you know, Cole had the sword, the sprite sword that was gifted to her by the sprites since, I guess I'll save the spoilers, but yeah, Cole gets a sword, a magic leaf sword, which is pretty cool. And that's the only weapon you have in Moss 1 until Twilight Garden, which was the DLC that came out for the Oculus release. You get a saber, and the saber it allows you to charge it. It has this sort of like additional layer to it. So when you press and hold attack, Quill raises the saber up in the air, and you reach into the world and boop her with the trigger, and you kind of charge it up with magic. And then when you attack next, it's a projectile. And so we were taking that philosophy of charging weapons, and we are bringing that to all of the weapons that we are going to ship in the game. And there's there's other weapons that were not shown in the trailer, of course. So that is really cool, and I think players are going to really love. Like, it kind of expands the possibility space of what we're able to do in the level, and fun little tricks to make the puzzles more intriguing and difficult. Hopefully not too difficult, but you will have to, you know, think about like positioning and charging your weapon and, you know, moving around the room a lot and sort of using this as a way to influence the room in more than just reaching in and grabbing something.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Would you say that this has more of an emphasis on combat than the first one did then?
I think it's about the same.
Okay.
I think that we, you know, we got some feedback from people who liked the game but found the combat difficult. And I think we don't want combat to be trivial, but we don't want it to be a barrier to entry, right? I think it's like an accessibility thing. If the combat's too difficult, the game becomes less accessible, and we just have to ask ourselves, like, is that really what we want? And for this game, for Moss, no, we want you to build your relationship with Quill, and we want to take you on this journey, and we want you to feel like there's real tension in the world, and so that we accomplish that with combat. And you know, as gamers, we love the, you know, like Danny, like he's a sandbox designer and he built, you know, some of the best sandbox abilities in Destiny. And so like, he knows controller feel. And, mm-hmm. and so when you're fighting with Quill and you're dashing and dodging and using different weapons and such, like that's the kind of legacy that we bring, because we still love those experiences, but we don't necessarily want to center them as the most important part of the experience.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
However, personally, I will say I would love to do that at some point with a VR game.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it definitely has its place, right? I can see this being an interesting uh-huh. game where if it was more focused around combat, there could be some ingenuity and creativity around the fact that you can literally stand up and kind of look at the map at all angles and see where certain attacks might be coming from. I'm sure there's different totally. Things that you could do from a VR perspective that you can't with just a normal, you know, flat 2D screen.
Yeah, definitely. Like the possibilities, like the designs that are out there that we just haven't found yet, are it's crazy. Like there's going to be, I really do think there will be an explosion of VR games once people realize that it's, you can make money on it, and it's it already is kind of saturated, right? But like way less saturated than, you know, the Steam indie page, right? Like
for sure. Yeah,
holy cow, it's a lot of work to get noticed, right? So if you can save yourself some of that labor of like marketing and just pick VR instead and say, hey, like I'm gonna just go ahead and make this concession, but you know, I'm gonna be in a smaller pool, but I'll be a bigger fish maybe. So
for sure, for sure. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, you mentioned the fact that you didn't want combat to be too difficult or too mm-hmm. trivial, right? You're mm-hmm. trying to find that balance. Was there any discussion among the team of saying, why don't we create difficulty levels?
Interesting. You know, that has not come up a whole lot. And I think that's because we're not passionate about building a difficult combat mm-hmm. experience.
Right.
Yeah, I think we would probably need a good reason to do it, I think.
Right. Right.
And I don't know what that reason would be, because it would be expensive is the first thing that I think of is like the dollars of having a designer, you know, to make all of those encounters over again with different enemies, or, you know, to tune it with different values, and then yeah. to test it all. That will be it would be a significant amount of work, not something that we wouldn't ever do, but that's
much more than is initially scoped for.
Exactly. We would scope that in the beginning. We would be like, okay, we're going to have multiple difficulty levels, so that means we need to run, you know, multiple test passes and so on and so forth.
Right, right. No, that totally makes sense. Now, mm-hmm. I love the idea, because hearing you talk, you are obviously very passionate about the world mm-hmm. of VR and mm-hmm. what it is capable of. Mm-hmm. I'm very much ignorant to the world of VR. I know some things about it, but I don't have my own set. I wish I did. It's one of the things that eventually mm-hmm. I will have to get, and I'm super mm-hmm. excited for whenever I do.
Totally.
But one of the things that interests me is, you know, there's been some time in between Moss 1 and now Moss 2 coming out. And me being, you know, an ignorant person in the space of VR, are there any, we talked about abilities and enhancements from a gameplay perspective. Are there any enhancements mm-hmm. or things that have changed from a VR perspective when it comes to Moss 1 and Moss 2?
Well, no, actually. That's the easy, simple answer, because we're shipping on PlayStation VR, which is, I think, one of the oldest consumer VR headsets in the market, which also means that it still is the number one. I think Sony has sold more headsets than anyone else at this point.
Wow.
Still.
Okay.
It's very quickly being eclipsed by Facebook and Oculus.
Right, I'm sure.
And I think when you look at active users, the PSVR is like very low. Like there's just not a lot of people playing PSVR right now. And that's just because the headset's, I think, 4 years old at this point. Yeah. And, you know, we were playing on the PSVR here in the studio because, you know, we're going to make sure that that's an incredible experience. We got to be playing on the Target hardware.
Right, of course.
Yeah. And it's still a great experience. Like playing Moss on the PSVR is still a joy. Like the headset is still super comfortable. You know, I still like using the DualShock. I still enjoy the sort of, seated gameplay style. Yeah. And I think the core design of Moss is like totally transfers, right? Like, you know, we've gone from the DualShock controller, which is, you know, you've got both hands on the DualShock 4. And when you're reaching into the world, with both hands versus mm-hmm. the Oculus version. You've got the touch controllers and you can reach in independently of each other. So, in Moss on PSVR, there's actually only one spirit hand, and on, you know, in the Oculus version, there's two. In the PSVR, the next gen, they posted some photos and they have a similar, they're going to be going with the touch controller style for their next headset. So that's one thing that has kind of evolved, and Sony's getting on board with that.
Right. And that's awesome to hear, but that brings up my next question, which is really around, it's awesome that you have one platform to really hone in on and make sure mm-hmm. that it works to that, you know, that one, and make sure that when people get that experience is going to be exactly the way that you're really envisioning. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, Moss One was also ported to other areas, other places that you could play the game. Is that at all on your radar, you know, down the road?
Oh, we want as many people to play it as quickly as possible. And just get it ready for everybody to experience. I think, you know, Sony understands that we, you know, really have relied on Oculus and other headset manufacturers for revenue. You know, it's a very candid thing. You know, this is just the reality of VR right now. And being a VR developer is the market's so small that to really be profitable, it's in our best interest to get the game out on all platforms. And so they're interested in our best interest as well. So that's been pretty cool. So they're on board with us, you know, bringing it to other platforms as soon as we can. And we'll have news on that soon. Hopefully, you know, not too long before we'll have an announcement date.
I look forward to it. Now I have one or two last questions to ask. But the first one I want to go into, I'm not sure if you can answer this one, but mm-hmm. I'm super into the idea of just Moss being about you reading a book, technically.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The concept of it works so perfectly from the side of it being VR and it being mm-hmm. you looking into the world, right? Mm-hmm. What was that inspiration, or why was it books at all?
You know, I don't think I can answer that one. I think you'd have to ask, you know, Corinne and Chris in the original Moss art team. But I will say I 100% agree with you. Like, it's such a cool premise to be in a library with a magic book and then to go into the book. And I'll tell you that is something that we've recognized and that we are delighted by as well. And we have some fun surprises in store for the player in book two. If you enjoyed that part of the game, be prepared to enjoy it again.
That is very exciting because I think, you know, and granted, it's a shame, but I'm glad that that kind of enthusiasm resonates elsewhere because it's such a good design principle when it comes to you being able to explain why you're able to kind of look around and mm-hmm. be this ominous figure. Whereas most games just kind of have you as just, you're there, you're looking in, but there's no explanation to it. Right. It's that break of the fourth wall. Whereas the mm-hmm. alternative could have been, it could have been just a much more VR type game where you are Moss, like you are, you are Quill, right? Not Moss, but you are Quill just walking mm-hmm. around and doing more of a like first person platforming type experience.
Right. Yeah. I think I agree 100%. I think that was one of the things that definitely they got right. It's entirely like it's because of VR, right? It's like it's a solution to a problem in VR. And I was talking to Peter, who's our finance guy, and I was like, "What is Polyarc? Is Polyarc a game company? Are we a VR game company?" And he's like, "No, we're an IP company." And I was like, "Oh, that's interesting." And I think that he's right in that, like the intellectual property of Moss and the game designs that are in it, and the story and the narration of it is just, it's all connected and it's all part of the Moss game. And
right.
And so that is, and that's our IP that we own. And I think that's really, and that kind of goes back to the indie thing, right? It's like, we want to have ownership of that, because we don't want to make compromises to people who aren't game developers. That's really kind of where we draw the line. And of course we have, and there's compromises everywhere, right? Like we'll still have to make compromises with our business partners, and there's always compromises with, you know, publishers and everything. Like, you know, even the best deals, you know, there's always compromises.
Of course.
Just business, you know, you try to get more than you can. so that's how it goes.
I get it. That, mm-hmm. I mean, I hear you. Unfortunately, you're never going to have a world where you can just 100% do what you want to do, because it's just not the way the world works. But that's okay, because it sounds like you're in a great position with great people that are on board with your vision, and that's what's important right now.
100%.
One of my last questions that I wanted to talk about, which I meant to ask at the start of this, but I got so wrapped up in other things, but really it's the idea of this being a continuation, right? This is book two. Does this pick up and start right where you left off from one?
Exactly where you left off.
Gotcha.
Like, and the place where Quill is standing.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah. All right. So you could literally, if you haven't played this one, once two comes out, you can literally play them back to back and be like, oh, it's just starting right off of.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hope that people do, because that is, you know, that's the Moss vision that was originally, this was the first Moss game that was, imagined. And so it'll be very cool to, and I'll probably do it myself, you know, to just sit down and play the full game on a PSVR headset, you know, at home on your couch. Like, that's going to be great.
Right. And for all those people who said, oh, it was a shorter experience, I wanted more, then it makes it even easier for you to be like, oh, just replay the first one. You know, if it's that short of an experience, it won't take that long. And then you could just continue through and get the full story.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I want to wrap this up with the last final question that we always love to ask on this show, which is really some advice. I love hearing advice from people who have all different kinds of walks of life and different places in the industry, right? For those who want to be in that indie space or want to be, you know, maybe an environment artist or do whatever it is in this kind of space, what's some advice that you would possibly give, you know, previous you or younger you, if you could?
I think I would definitely advise myself to just get good at learning new skills online. That is, I think, the number one ticket to success in video games, and I think any video game development career, it's kind of the same. Like, you know, Brendan Walker, he's one of our engineers. He sits right next to me, and he jokes about how he, being a good engineer, is actually just knowing how to use Stack Overflow, which is a website for basically, like, it's kind of like Reddit, where people ask questions and then answers are upvoted and downvoted. And so, you know, it's a lot of, you need to take in information and knowledge from the internet and, you know, digest it and then use that to, you know, do something new or learn something new, to solve a new challenge, to solve a new problem. And if you can get comfortable with being pushed. And if you can be comfortable growing, and growth is hard. Growth is really hard. Like, there's like when I worked on a character recently, and I was getting frustrated on it because, you know, I wasn't used to struggling. I had my comfort zone and environments, and, you know, I was using a new program that, you know, I hadn't used before, and I was just not able to accomplish what I was trying to accomplish. And that happens to everybody all the time. Right. Like that happened. I mean, it literally just happened to me, and I've been in the industry for 10 years. And, I think, you know, when you're in those moments, it's how do you cope with it? And, what do you do when you're feeling discouraged? And for me, I love, just hitting people up, asking for feedback, asking for advice, asking for someone to look at something. You know, that's like, usually I just need advice. I need some help, and sometimes it's done and I just don't know it yet. And, and I've been noodling on a detail that actually doesn't matter. And so, getting right. the outside perspective helps a lot too.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That's great advice. For those cool. listening, Moss Book 2 is currently in development. Keep an eye on their Twitter page at Polyarch Games for any sneak peeks, updates. Once again, Kulit, thank you so much for joining today.
Of course. Thank you for having me on, Joshua. It was a pleasure.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.